Olivia here. I want to tell you about a new podcast from Axios called One Big Thing. It's hosted by Nyla Budu and features interviews with leaders you know or need to know in business, politics, and culture. Each week, you'll hear one big conversation on the trends shaping our world from people like Surgeon General Vivek Murthy, technology reporter Ina Fried, and chef and humanitarian Jose Andres. So go ahead, listen to One Big Thing on your favorite podcast app. New episodes drop every Thursday.
Unexplainable is a science show about everything we don't know. Like, we don't know how bikes work.
Get out. Come on.
We don't know where the moon came from.
Holy cow.
You've touched the moon.
This is incredible.
We don't even know what life is.
No one has been able to define life, and some people will tell you it's not possible to.
Unexplainable takes you right up to the edge of what we know and keeps going. New episodes every Wednesday, wherever you get your podcasts.
Hello, and welcome to Raising Health, where we explore the real challenges and enormous opportunities facing the entrepreneurs who are building the future of health. I'm Olivia.
And I'm Chris. Today's episode is with Joe Grogan, who is currently serving as senior fellow at the Leonard D. Schaefer Center for Health Policy and Economics at the University of Southern California. He has also held a number of senior government positions, most recently as the Associate Director of Health at the Office of Management and Budget and as a domestic policy advisor to former President Donald Trump. He is joined by Vijay Pandey, General Partner at A16Z Bio and Health.
Joe shared his experience working in government during the early days of the COVID pandemic, as well as his opinions on the IRA as it relates to drug pricing and R&D.
It's already warping R&D programs. I mean, when you talk to companies, in the past, when Congress passed something on drug pricing or they changed regulatory structure, the heads of R&D, they did not freak out. Mm. The heads of commercial lost some sleep, but they were like, we'll figure a way around this. But after the IRA passed, the heads of R&D, the heads of commercial, everybody sits around now and they're like, how are we going to work in this structure?
Joe also shared his thoughts about AI regulation and how policymakers could approach this technology.
These regulations, the executive order, they're all fear-mongering. I think this is a huge opportunity. I don't think the regulations will prevent anything bad from happening, but I do believe they could severely inhibit innovation in this space, and the U.S. needs to dominate it because our competitors sure as hell are not going to be held back by concerns around this issue. They want to dominate it. They want to eat our lunch. And we have to have AI if we are going to get cost compression in healthcare and better outcomes.
You're listening to Raising Health from A16Z Bio and Health.
So, Joe, thank you so much for joining us on Raising Health.
Thanks for having me. It's an honor.
You know, you recently headed the Domestic Policy Council during the Trump administration. It's a very important role. What was your mindset going into that type of role, especially in a charged political environment?
I was fortunate in that I had worked in the Bush administration 7 years at Health and Human Services, 2 at FDA. I ran the Presidential Advisory Council on HIV and AIDS, and I had worked at the Administration for Children and Families. So I'd gotten an education in the nuts and bolts of government. And then at the beginning of the Trump administration, I was at the Office of Management and Budget, which is on the White House complex. It's in the adjacent building to the proper White House. And I was focused on healthcare. I was the associate director for health. And that was really an intense job. It was a great job, in many ways, the best job I ever had. Great team of people. So by the time I became domestic policy advisor, I had a lot of experience. I went into it knowing I will probably never have the opportunity to work in the West Wing again. And then by the time I left in May 2020, it was time for me to go. You're going to bust your butt and leave it all on the table.
No, that's the way to do it. I think must have been kind of very special thing to be in the White House during COVID. Such a sort of monumental thing in terms of the history of healthcare. And what was it like being on the job in those times, especially in the early days of COVID?
Look, there are always these healthcare epidemics that pop up. You know, there's a big screen at HHS, a whole wall of screens where they're showing various outbreaks all over the world of various things that are concerning people, concerning the Center for Disease Control. And the presidential daily brief, Frequent will make mention, hey, listen, there's a new outbreak of Marburg in the Congo and three people have died, or it's in Angola. Sometimes you need to deploy public health people. The CDC will go in. Sometimes the WHO gets involved. They can bubble up to concern and even deployment of American assets, but most of the time they burn out. You know, whether it's a food safety outbreak or an ill, epidemic, a infectious disease. So in the beginning, you're watching this and you're like, is this like everything else? Mm-hmm. And then suddenly you start to go, wait a second. And the first reaction when you're a domestic policy advisor, because you have a policy hat, but you also have a political hat, is, wait a second, is this going to be a political liability if we don't get organized really quick on this? Mm. And we need to be prepared. And that was my original thing. Like, this is now, there's now enough traffic about this. I'm hearing about it. It may burn out, but we need to make sure that we're prepared if it doesn't, that it's not a mess. And I think I was the first person, the first assistant to the president to call for a meeting on the subject. And we had a meeting in the chief of staff's office with a number of other senior people. When I said, look, if we don't get organized, this is going to cost us the election. And that was in January. And we started to scramble and get ready for it. And it only got worse. You know, the numbers only got worse. The spread only got worse. The response only got worse. The opacity of the Chinese only got worse. But I would have given anything that I was being overly concerned, you know, that it was like, sure, oh, Grogan's being paranoid. We just wasted time in this meeting. And it's just like so many other diseases of concern. It just kind of burn out.
Well, was there something that in particular that you saw that made it different than SARS before or something else? Like, what was the turning point for you?
It's funny. I was looking at some of the daily briefs at the intel briefs, and I just had a bad feeling that maybe I wasn't getting intel from HHS. I was getting more from the Department of Health and Human Services. I wasn't getting calls from them, but I was close with Bob Redfield, the head of the CDC. I had known him from the Bush administration. He was on the Presidential Advisory Council on HIV and AIDS, and he spent a lot of time educating me on that disease. And he called me up and he said, you know, this is starting to get me a little worried. Gottlieb was out of the government at the time, and he and I started talking, and I started to see Twitter traffic. But, you know, weird things started to happen. I can't remember the timeline, but the North Koreans shut down their border with China. And I was like, man, if the North Koreans are shutting their border down with China and those dudes are concerned, we should be pretty freaked out about what's going on, because this isn't just the Chinese overreacting. This is other countries around them, and the North Koreans can't really afford to be shutting their border down. And it was just a confluence of a lot of things that came together all at once.
But then, you know, you end up on the coronavirus task force. What was that like? And how do you like even start to go after something like this? Like, you know, how do you set priorities?
Pretty quickly, Vice President Pence took over. He had a lot of attributes that were positive. He'd been a governor, and we knew we were going to need governors. He had been a member of Congress, and we were going to need to communicate with Congress. He was well-respected as an honest broker. The president respected him. He had a good team on the VP staff. His chief of staff was a friend of mine. His policy lead had worked with me at OMB. But the table was huge in the Situation Room, and you had to have everybody there. I mean, remember in the beginning, our number one focus to the point of distraction was this lunacy of cruise ships calling up and saying, we have COVID on our cruise ship.
That's right.
And all these passengers are infected. We just had somebody die. We have our crews infected, and we are now quarantined in Japan. And there were false reports of COVID on ships and panic. And we were evacuating crews with the Centers for Disease Control, the State Department, the Department of Transportation. Like, everybody's involved in this. It is not a minor issue to bring a boatload of American citizens off of a cruise ship with other citizens, evacuate them in a way that the pilots of those planes are not going to get infected, that the medical crews are not going to get infected. It was a huge logistical thing to the point of, like, everybody's having this discussion around evacuating a cruise ship. And then we were like, we could spend all our time just working on various cruise, and then cruise ship stuff. Meanwhile, there's other things going on, like trying to get PPE, you know, the personal protective equipment, the mask, the gloves, where are we going to get all this stuff? And so, you know, looking back on it, you wouldn't say, oh, who was around the table? Of course, the head of the Center for Disease Control, of course, the head of Health and Human Services. No, like every agency was represented because you needed Homeland Security because they have people at airports that are going to be checking to see if people have fevers. And you have every single department looking at this stuff, deployed, concerned about it. The Treasury Department, of course, was a massive economic problem. Mm-hmm. We were shutting travel down from Europe after we shut it down, which is a much bigger economic issue than shutting down travel from China. We had ports backing up. So it was just, to say it was a fire hose is an understatement. It was about 40 fire hoses shooting constantly. You do one big meeting where people would go through top line subjects, they would go back, and then everybody would be hustling on a gazillion elements of those issues and dozens more.
I could spend the whole time just talking about COVID. It's been so fascinating and so important for the future, but I think we got two other, I think, pretty important topics I want to get to as well. How about let's switch gears to talk about drug pricing and especially the most recent Inflation Reduction Act. You know, you've written several opinion pieces on IRA and its implementation and so on. Could you summarize sort of your take on the IRA for the audience?
Well, so the IRA, the Inflation Reduction Act, if you're not in healthcare, you're focused on the elements of electric vehicle subsidies and all this other renewable energy subsidies that were inserted into the bill. But for people in healthcare, the big component is the price controls for drugs. And they came up with a very convoluted structure and they rammed it through without any Republican votes. Now, as an initial matter, all drug pricing legislation in the past had been done on a bipartisan basis. Orrin Hatch, Republican senator from Utah, Henry Waxman, one of the most liberal Democrat members from California, collaborated to create basically the structure for the generic drug industry to take off. And it was a balance of innovators get X number of years for becoming the first to market and spending all that money on R&D and winning the race. And over that, and for getting new indications, they get extended protection and marketing exclusivity. And data exclusivity, so it can't be shared with other people. And then, boom, generic companies can come in and prices will collapse and it's going to become a commodity-based structure. Well, the IRA was totally partisan. So as an initial matter, your hair should be up on the back because there's no way to build decent legislation without compromise of access and innovation in this space. And it's all focused on setting prices for innovative drugs, and it's going to be a real problem. I mean, I'm a firm believer that government setting price controls is not only inefficient, but it always, everywhere, leads to shortages. There is no way you can tell the marketplace that somebody in remotely can push on a marketplace and say, this is the price that we believe. It didn't work in the basement of the Politburo when the Stalinists were doing it for wheat. It is sure as hell not going to do it for anything more as complicated as drug R&D, and it's going to collapse. I mean, the other thing they did was they inserted in there to circumvent the Administrative Procedures Act, which people roll their eyes and are like, what the hell's that? Well, it gives private industry and stakeholders an opportunity to comment, to force government to build an evidence base for their regulatory actions and what they do to private sector. And Congress just said, oh, you don't really need to do these things anymore. You don't need to issue regulation. So I'm very despondent about the direction of the Inflation Reduction Act. And let me just say this. At the beginning of the Biden administration, look, I'm a Republican. I didn't vote for Biden, of course. But I, as any American would, new president, I want to be an optimist, right? And he built, he started his administration with potentially what would have been a golden age for biomedical innovation. He put Eric Lander from the Broad Institute in charge of Office of Science, Technology, and Policy. He brought in a ton of people with biopharmaceutical expertise into that office. Janet Woodcock was acting at the Food and Drug Administration. I was hopeful she was going to get confirmed. We had other people. He talked about the cancer moonshot. He had other people that around him that believed in biopharmaceutical innovation. You look at it now, you know, Janet's retiring, as so many other great people at FDA have. Lander got blown out. They pursued idiotic legislation like the Inflation Reduction Act, which makes a mockery of cancer moonshot because so many companies have been canceling cancer programs lately.
Right.
And it's very sad for patients today and tomorrow.
But then there's this nuance of small molecule, you know, the pills, they have pretty severe limits, but biologics like antibodies are not as bad. It also therefore sets up this, I think, unintended consequence that you'll get all these more expensive drugs. Because you could have a small molecule or you could have an antibody. A pharma company now would be incented to do the antibody and actually would end up costing patients more.
Absolutely. It's already warping R&D programs. I mean, when you talk to companies, in the past, when Congress passed something on drug pricing or they changed the regulatory structure, the heads of R&D, they did not freak out. The heads of commercial lost some sleep, but they were like, we'll figure a way around this. But after the IRA passed, it is consistent that the heads of R&D, the heads of commercial, everybody sits around now and they're like, how are we going to work in this structure? And one of the more moronic things that they've done now is if you are an orphan, if you have an orphan drug indication, so that's a very small population. We built a whole incentive structure for this, by the way, in the United States. To encourage companies to do it. And now if you have more than one indication, you are subject to the negotiations. And so who's going to do that second? Who's going to do the research to develop it? No one's going to go for that indication because your entire economic motivation has been blown to kingdom come.
For me personally, I have a lot of empathy for people who can't get the healthcare they want, but I also have empathy for the patients that are going to die because they don't have the treatments that could have existed. And I think that second part, I think, is the part that people don't look at. And it's going to be a challenge. I think it's until healthcare, I think, is viewed differently, we're going to be in the situation where it's going to be crippled. I think with good intentions, with, I think, unexpected outcomes.
Right. I mean, look, the most expensive drug is the one that's not developed.
Yeah. Yeah.
I mean, if you are a patient who has no options, regardless of cost, price, whatever, you're as poor as it gets.
Yeah.
You know, yeah. I mean, that's the thing. Frequently, a very expensive drug can be, companies make it available at cost, make it available for free. And eventually, with the structure that Hatch-Waxman created, it'll go generic. So it's a balance that you've got to create. And that's why I'm a firm believer in bipartisanship in this area, because it takes push and pull, compassion and economic understanding and an understanding of the innovation ecosystem to actually make it work.
Yeah. So maybe one last question and we'll move on to the last topic. Where can we go from here? You talked about bipartisanship. That makes sense that it's got to be part of it. But like, where do we go from here, given that the IRA is law?
Well, it's an irony that the same summer that they passed the IRA, which did grievous damage to our pharmaceutical industry and open the door to do even more. They also passed the CHIPS Act in order to incentivize microchip development. So we used to dominate that industry, right? Then suddenly it all goes overseas. And now we decided, we need to spend a bunch of subsidies and do all this do all this government spending to incentivize and create an American industry again. Well, we dominate biopharmaceutical innovation, right? But the Chinese want to eat our lunch. There's more research being done in Singapore. There are always other countries that want to take our industries and our competitive advantage away. Unfortunately, I think if we don't revisit this issue shortly, we're going to be having to do a CHIPS Act for the biopharmaceutical industry in 20 years, where we're going to sit there and go, holy smokes, how is it that we used to develop 80 to 90% of new molecules in the United States? How is it that we used to lead over and over again and that we were the engine, and suddenly we're down to 60, 40, 20% because the Chinese are doing this, because the Koreans are doing this, because the Japanese are doing it. Maybe the Europeans will wake up, or some of the countries will wake up and start doing it. So what I would like to see is some type of rationality brought around the drug pricing provisions in a bipartisan fashion to say, hey, look, every once in a while, there's going to be a rogue actor, you know, a Martin Scorsese or some company that goes out there and sees an arbitrage opportunity and cranks it way up. And maybe there's an intervention that could be done, because patents are granted by the government. Market exclusivity is granted by the government. Maybe there's a way if there's a generic drug out there that somebody has cranked up, that it could be, we could contract with somebody to sell it and have a second supplier. Maybe there's a way we could have licensing be done to create more manufacturers if there was a shortage situation. But I think ultimately what you need is innovation on the payment side. We've had tons of innovation. The bulk of my career when I first came to DC was spent around getting drugs through FDA more flexibility around FDA scientific approvals. We have not devoted that level of flexibility to the reimbursement for drugs. You should have a plethora of different ways to purchase drugs in this country and to get coverage for yourself. You know, unfortunately, we're going the other way on reimbursement. The Biden administration just wants the Affordable Care Act to dominate the entire commercial market. And it's so heavily regulated. You know, we should have value-based contracting. We should have bulk contracting. We should have different guys like Mark Cuban who are diving into generic distribution. He should come up with 10 different products next year if this market was deregulated. And we would have more competition in purchasing and more ways for people to access drugs and more reimbursement innovation for all types of healthcare. And unfortunately, we don't have that. So I'd like to see different types of coverage be done and more, not the trend towards one size fits all.
Yeah, that makes a ton of sense. So let's switch gears. My personal belief is AI is going to have a huge, huge impact in healthcare. We're always seeing, you know, glimpses of that. But, you know, at the same time, the sort of AI's ability to do things is also, I think, giving people pause. It's leading to talk about regulation. And obviously, there's an executive order recently. You know, what's your perspective on sort of the policy regulation side of AI, especially now that's becoming, I think, such an important topic?
I've seen so many of these regulatory debates over my time where something akin to like the Dutch tulip mania takes over, where suddenly everybody needs to regulate this area. And the frenzy around and the rhetoric around regulating AI among DC politicians and policymakers, when it becomes quickly apparent they have no idea what the hell they are talking about, is very alarming to me. I mean, I recently, and it's alarming on the conservative and the Republican side too, because I kept on waiting for somebody else to step up, like on the conservative side. And finally I got together a group of conservative healthcare thinkers, because I didn't want to bring in tech people necessarily. I wanted to confront it from a health perspective on the conservative side and say, guys, shouldn't we get some principles out here? This is a big opportunity for healthcare. We can, are we all on the same page? We can save money. Are we all on the page that we don't need another huge federal bureaucracy to regulate AI, right? We all realize that AI in transportation is going to be different than AI for diagnostics. AI is going to be different for drug discovery than it is going to be for AI in financial markets. There's no way that you can create one giant agency, which a lot of people, particularly on the left, were talking about. So with Naomi Lopez from Goldwater Institute, we formed a group of conservatives, kind of issued some principles around regulation because no one else was doing it. And then we talked, well, I recently had Adam Thier, who's a good conservative thinker around AI, on a podcast that I do called DCEKG. And we talked about the fact that we've screwed this up before with nuclear regulation.
Right.
We screwed this up with overregulation.
Nuclear energy, nuclear power.
Yeah, exactly right. And we frequently create the illusion of government protection with regulation that doesn't protect us in the end, right? There, every time there's a financial crisis, the response is, oh, we need more regulation. Well, wait, we just did more regulation. Why didn't it stop it? I have so much hope for AI as somebody who thinks there's too many federal employees who are basically looking at widgets and manufacturing widgets when we should be evaluating data. When I think about the fact that we can finally get cost compression and savings with AI, we could develop drugs more quickly. We could put tools in the hands of FDA reviewers that allows them to review data more quickly and approve a drug more quickly and spot adverse events, and also have more confidence in the aftermarket surveillance to say, wait a second, there's a signal here. It turns out that suddenly 65-year-old plus men with a heart condition are dropping dead. Yep. And AI can spot that in a drug.
Very early.
And so, right. And these regulations, the executive order, they're all fear-mongering. I don't share it. I think this is a huge opportunity. I don't think the regulations will prevent anything bad from happening. But I do believe they could severely inhibit innovation in this space. And the U.S. needs to dominate it in all aspects because our competitors sure as hell are not going to be held back by concerns around this issue. They want to dominate it. They want to eat our lunch. And we have to have AI if we are going to get cost compression in healthcare and better outcomes.
Yeah,
we spend too much, we get terrible outcomes.
Yeah, that's the irony, is that this could lower costs, improve outcomes. It's exactly what we're looking for. And I think the analogy of nuclear is pretty clear in the sense that I don't think people were thinking about, well, what's the worst that could happen if we just burn up a ton of petroleum? And now there's a lot of concern about that. And that nuclear could have avoided that.
Right.
And can be done safely and so on. So it's one of these things, kind of like the drugs that don't exist. Those are things that people don't worry about, but those are the huge missed opportunities. But, you know, a part of politics is doing this in a bipartisan way, understanding that people have other points of view. How do we help people to see that there is so much good in what AI can do, and that the doomerism, the concerns are really not concerns? How do we get that message across?
Yeah, it's tough. I think we need to hear more from smaller innovators. I think there's a great deal of skepticism of some of the big tech companies who are advocating for regulation. We're in a, on the right and the left right now, we're in a populist moment where people are skeptical of some of the bigger companies who are advocating for regulation, and rightly so. I don't believe that, frankly, Google is showing up in Washington, D.C. because they think that regulation in this space is going to inhibit their ability to innovate. I think they're trying to game the regulatory system for their own benefit and squelch competition.
And that's that's their play, right? I mean, that's what probably what they should be doing if you're a Google shareholder, but not if you are looking for what's best for the country.
Right. I mean, unfortunately, it is a game that it is like the siren song for big companies. Once they get a taste of Washington, D.C., they're in all the way to regulate and use the regulatory system to punish competitors and give themselves a competitive advantage. It's one of the worst things, one of the most distasteful things about the DC lobbying game. And I was a registered lobbyist. I slept well at night and was proud of the work that I did. And I don't have any shame in it. But the companies, regardless of industry, who try to use the regulatory system for their own benefit, but more importantly, for the detriment of their competitors, are a problem. And it's clearly happening in AI. So I think Americans love small companies who are winners, right? They love the innovator story, the Wright brothers, the Henry Fords. They love them and they root for them. And we need to hear more voices about the opportunities that AI is creating And we're in a race because I think the small innovators really need to show this promise as quickly as possible before these regulations start to bite and before it really takes hold, because I think the American people will start to see the promise over the fear, because I think the fear is very amorphous.
Mm-hmm.
Even now, like, I don't understand what everybody is clamoring about. Like, yes. What are they talking about? Are they worried that there's going to be a huge financial crisis developed by securitized investment vehicles or credit default swaps? We just had it. Now, dude, you know, like, what the hell are you talking about? We're going to have a pandemic due to AI? We just had one. I mean, like, we're going to have a world war? Yeah, we've had them. I mean, what are you saying? What is going to be so much more damaging?
Yeah. Well, I think you so beautifully sort of described all the good sides of what's coming. So looking forward to collectively supporting that and supporting founders. Joe, thank you so much for being on the podcast.
It was fun. I love the conversation, and I look forward to meeting you in person, VJ, and continuing the conversation.
Same here.
Thank you for listening to Raising Health. Raising Health is hosted and produced by me, Chris Tatiosian,
and me, Olivia Webb,
with the help of the Bio and Health team at A16Z. The show is edited by Phil Hegseth.
If you want to suggest topics for future shows, you can reach us at raisinghealth@a16z.com. Finally, please rate and subscribe to our show. The content here is for informational purposes only, should not be taken as legal, business, tax, or investment advice, or be used to evaluate any investment or security, and is not directed at any investors or potential investors in any A16Z fund. Please note that A16Z and its affiliates may maintain investments in the companies discussed in this podcast. For more details, including a link to our investments, please see a16z.com/disclosures.